Christian Shepherd, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I got to tell you, when I first got the book and I saw the name, I don't know if you're familiar with the TV show Lost, but I was wondering if this was like a pseudonym, because the main character is Jack Shepherd, and his father was Christian Shepherd.
And they're both Red Sox fans.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That was a
And
reference to that.
I've encountered that before. I've gone to restaurants, and the look of disappointment on the maitre d's face when they see me, thinking, "Oh, this is not Christian Shepherd from Lost." But
Yeah,
I like
so it's
a lot.
you're not a fictional character, I'm saying.
No.
So we're here to talk about your new book, The Ancient Wisdom of Baseball: Lessons from Life, from Homer's Odyssey to the World Series. Now, I'm loath to admit, but in my high school days and even college days, I've never read the Odyssey, but I will be picking it up after we finish with this. So why did you decide, what is your background? Why did you decide to do a baseball book in this fashion?
Well, my background with the Odyssey. I mean, I was lucky enough to start reading it early on, like in high school and everything. But when I was getting, I have a doctorate in religion and literature from the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. Sort of my expertise is being a professor of literature and religion, and specifically studying from the point of view of rhetoric and how people trying to communicate what they experience as ineffable experiences of ultimate reality, what type of literary means do they use to try to describe those experiences? So my dissertation was actually on Walt Whitman and Walt Whitman's mysticism. And my first book I edited is a collection from the University of Chicago Press on comparative mysticism, talking from modern mystics to medieval mystics to ancient Greek inspired people claiming to have met Zeus. And so that was my point of view. But how I came at writing a book about baseball is sort of from that same background. I was all but dissertation. My wife had her maternity leave had ended, and I was taking care of my baby daughter Cecilia. And one day I was pushing this old perambulator out of the front door of the Divinity School. And if you've never been to the University of Chicago, but if you've seen Harry Potter or Hogwarts, if you've been to Oxford, that's what it looks like. It has very much this gothic feel with gargoyles and crosses everywhere. And I'm pushing this baby out, and one of my fellow graduate students walks out from like behind a tree where she had been smoking a cigarette and looks down at the baby and says, "Hey, how are you going to raise it?" Right? And that's a strange question to be asked, anywhere in America. Usually you don't ask people questions to be polite. What is your religious affiliation? How much money do you make? Did you pay your taxes? What's your preferred sexual position? These are not polite questions. But here, where everyone had gone in order to like ask religious questions, it wasn't off the wall. And of course, having dedicated my life to the study of religion, I had no ready answer. I had all these doubts, I had all these questions, but I had no answer. But this is a question that I wanted an answer to. In order to stave off my fellow student, I kind of flippantly said, "I'm going to raise her a Cubs fan," right?
There you go.
And I thought later, like, huh, what if the questions that we usually put to religions and philosophies, meaning what is all of ultimate reality? And more importantly, how do we live in it? Like ethical questions, what is virtue and how to pursue happiness? If we were to ask these questions of baseball, what kind of answer would we get? And I just so happened, as my day job was taking care of the baby and supposedly finishing my dissertation, which I did. But my night job was teaching the great books at the University of Chicago. I was teaching the classics, Homer, Plato. And what I found when I was considering baseball from a philosophical, ethical, religious, spiritual point of view was that it was this game that had heroes. And what these heroes did, what my heroes did, what Andre Dawson did, what eventually Jake Arrieta would do, is they would exemplify excellence. They would, and in particular ways, if they were hitting, they would show courage. If they were pitching, they had the head game, and they'd be prudent, they'd be canny, they'd be cunning. Any player in the field, they needed to be like well-tempered, make those good actions their actual reactions through habitual practice. And what I saw was this notion of a world where virtue is exemplified by heroes, was the same world that was in the Iliad and the Odyssey, was in Homer, where Homer told these epic stories of heroes. You don't have to read, I mean, I recommend that you read the Odyssey, but if you're familiar, and I know you are, with all like epic literature, whether it be Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, there you have that same sort of pattern of heroes searching for victory, and in the conflicts that ensue, their characters are forged. And baseball, I hold that each ball game is like the ritual reenactment of a myth in which that is played out. And so we go, we witness, but it's a lot more fun, and you can have a hot dog while you're watching it.
Now, since you use the word myth, I'm going to jump ahead to your definition of myth. You define myth as a story, whereas I think, as you also say, when somebody says, "Well, that's a myth," that's something that's unbelievable, that's not true. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, nowadays, when I think in our modern world, our disenchanted modern world, where everyone's rational or pretends to be rational, when they say something, that's it's just a myth. It's just a myth. It doesn't meaning it's not true. It doesn't matter. The old definition of myth, when you take it to be just story, and the definition of myth that is developed by modern scholars of religion like Carl Jung or Marcia Eliade, these great scholars of religion. The idea of a myth is a story that resonates with something larger than mere rationality can describe, right? So it's these larger than life stories that resonate with, what perhaps is going on in the cosmos, but at least with what's going on in your own psyche. Right. So they're these powerful resonant stories. So rather than a myth, is it's just myth. When I use myth, I use it in the same way that, Howard Cosell would call Reggie Jackson mythic or something like that. It's touched with hyperbole when I use it.
Because you mentioned one of the most famous myths, and the older I get, the farther back in history this goes, is Babe Ruth calling a shot in the World Series. Some people absolutely say it happened. Some people say if he had done anything like that, the pitcher would have knocked him down. So yeah, I mean, you don't you you find those stories with people of. With players of that generation, you don't find too many mythical stories of something that happened, say, in the Cubs World Series victory just a few years ago. Maybe 50 years from now, people will talk about it in those terms, but right now, not. And now you concentrate on the three things that stuck out for me is your discussion of the 2004 Red Sox World Series, the 2016 Cubs victory. And both those teams had not won in generations, so that was very interesting. And the thing that also stuck to me was your discussion of the Bartman game. Why did you decide to include that?
Well, one thing I wrote this book over a long period of time, and it occurred to me that what I was doing was giving the fans perspective. And fan, you should know, you probably know, the word fan goes back to the notion of fanatic, and that the etymology of that word goes back to someone who spent too much time in the ancient pagan temple, someone who spent too much time inhaling the fumes from the sacrificial altar, so they became kind of unhinged. So to imagine someone, spending too much time near the hot dog stand or something, and just inhaling that and then becoming obsessed. My point of view is the fan's point of view, and Bartman, he that loss. What struck me when I was going back over that story, it's not an official fan interference. It's the ump it's an unof He didn't interfere with the ball, according to the umpires, right? And yet everyone who was there, everyone who was watching, they blamed all the blame accrued to Bartman. It's almost like group psychology or something, or the ma mass hysteria. He was immediately scapegoated. And what struck me about Bartman is he was the quintessential fan. I mean, he's dressed like you with the black turtleneck and the Cubs hat, and he had the earphones in. And it was really, but for the grace of Zeus, go I could have any Cubs fan could have been Bartman if they had just, if they had just been the wrong place at the wrong time and paying the wrong kind of attention. And what's interesting about it is, from the comparing the rash, I think this you and I have talked a little bit about the rationalist point of view versus what I would call a larger point of view. I get into this argument with the people who sort of the post Moneyball people who focus just so much on the numbers that they begin to disabuse themselves of the notion of clutch. And is there clutch? Yes. Is there choke? Yes. Bartman is another version of that. How does a moment in the game make everything turn? You know, you announcers talk about momentum. Like they're using the terms of physics to describe what's going on in the minds of a team because they don't have any other words for it. But you can feel it. Well, you can feel it when the momentum changes. When Aaron Judge drops that ball, right? And then suddenly five unearned runs and the Dodgers take it. Like how does that occur? So if you're a Red Sox fan, you've heard of Big Poppy and you know clutch is real. Mm-hmm. But for those people who aren't so blessed, you can be duped into thinking that it's only a myth. But I and for me, it's still a mystery to be observed and to wonder how certain things happen in the game, in your life, in the culture that just seem to turn. And what I've come up with is that we're telling ourselves constantly stories. We're telling ourselves constantly a story. And it's no coincidence that it's those moments are like little climaxes or turns in the plot that then everyone kind of buys into and fulfills their role in. You know, we're stuck in stories in our own minds. And one of the things I love about baseball is it allows you to kind of be the audience, like the ancient Greek chorus to these stories and cheer and jeer depending upon where you are in it.
Now, you mentioned that this book was written over a long period of time. When you started, your daughter was how old?
When I started, my daughter was less than a year old.
Less than a year old.
So she's 25 now.
It kind of reminds me of a situation with my daughter when she, on her second birthday, we were visiting friends in Binghamton, New York, and we went to the minor league ball game there. And when she was an infant, my lullaby to her was take me out to the ball game.
Nice.
So when we got there, I came to the seventh inning and everybody started singing it. Like she looks around, she was like stunned. Everybody knows this song. So
yeah.
that was a happy memory for me.
Yeah, I had a moment like that in the book too. When I remember vividly when Cecilia first became aware of taking me out to the ball game at the park, and the notion that just all these people who had been sort of little atoms floating around doing their own thing, keeping the score, eating food, suddenly all stand up together and all sing along. She, after the end, everyone sat down. She's like, again, let's do that again.
Now, you mentioned she's an adult now. This book came out fairly recently. Did you show her the manuscript along the way? Did you consult with her at all? Did she have any issues with, I mean, I think, well, she's a little bit older, so she's more mature, but like if she had been a teenager now, she might have said, oh, Dad, you know, you're embarrassing me. I don't want to be in your story. Was there any discussion along the way?
Well, you know, she's a very great disposition. And so she's been very supportive. I didn't really give her the choice. I let her read it before it was going well. And there was there in one slightly earlier part, I have a section on Chris Bryant, and I shouldn't even be saying this because she had me take it out. But there was when she was a teenager, I think she kind of had a crush on Chris Bryant, but and there was a slight allusion to that. And she says, Daddy, that's cringy. Take that out. But I do actually have, you know, Chris Bryant in Chicago, this young player, was phenomenal, especially in that 2016 year and the few years before. So, you know, he's one of the few contemporary players where I talk about what it means for a young player to kind of achieve this level of fan devotion and appreciation. And she loved Chris Bryant like we all do
mm-hmm.
in Chicago. Now,
again, you this was written over a period of time. I'm always curious, how much do you rely on your memory versus going back and doing, let's say, research on the game? Because as a lot of people know, memories tend to be fuzzy. Your memory, we could be watching the same game in the same place at the same time, and your memory of something will be different than mine. So what was your process along those lines?
Yeah, that's a great question. My wife and I have this argument all the time. She's She's a very diligent person, and I'm kind of a more of a storyteller. And I think for one thing I like about this book is I feel like when I tell the stories, this is why I think you don't necessarily need to read The Odyssey to read my book. I tell the stories in a way that's I think pretty alive, pretty vivid. I think I retell the baseball stories that are pretty alive and pretty vivid. And the reason why is because I'm telling them from memory when I'm writing them. And so for me, there are flashes of moments that I'm trying to get to, that I'm trying to convey. After I write it, I'll go back and make corrections to make them correct. And I didn't succeed all the time, but my wife, the first editor, and the editors, my publisher, they'll go back and say, well, El Duque's pitch sequence was not quite the way you remembered it, and I'll try to fix it that way. But really, what I'm trying to do is do justice to my memory of the meaning of the moments that I'm recalling, which gets me in trouble, and then I have to rewrite things. But I think it pays off in the energy I bring to the telling of the story.
Now you mentioned working with editors. It's always helpful to have someone at the publisher who's knowledgeable in your topic. It seems like you had that experience.
No, I didn't have
Oh, whoops.
they weren't knowledgeable in the topic. They were fantastic editors. And actually, this is one thing that was great, because I was so, I'm so into Homer and I'm so into baseball. And my primary editor, she's an athlete. She actually is a coach for archery, and she actually helped with the specifics of describing Odysseus shooting the arrow. She gave me some nice, but she kind of took a larger view and I think helped me write it for people who haven't read The Odyssey and people who aren't necessarily baseball fans. I think I keep it at a level of that. And one of the things that, for example, when I was talking about temperance and that virtue of temperance, when people have to keep themselves tempered, she said, you describe this well, but one thing that would help is, can you describe it when someone loses their temper? And I said, I can. And I went back to my journal from before, because I remembered vividly when Lou Piniella gets in an argument with one of the umpires at Wrigley Field, and I was there with Cecilia. And that little piece of the book was, say, put in, maybe a month outside of done date. It was one of the last things I was putting in that book, but it was actually had been written in large part, that afternoon when I got back from the game with my daughter.
You were the narrator for the audio version of the book, which I always like, admire, because I think no one knows better than the author what the book should sound like. So talk about, first of all, not every book becomes an audio book. So let's talk about the decision to make it into an audio book and the decision to use you as a narrator.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm really happy with the audiobook. I'm glad we did it, even though it cost more money than to have a voice actor do it. And it could cost more time and more energy on my part. But I feel like this book is written in my voice. I've people who know me and are reading the book and will say, I can just hear your voice when I'm reading this book. So I felt that my voice is one, because it speaks for the fan, and I'm speaking from my own particular point of view. And I didn't realize this till after it was published, but I've had people tell me that when they read my account of my fandom, of my experience with certain games, they're automatically like finding analogies in their own life. They're automatically saying, oh, that reminds me of a game I saw. That reminds me of going to the ball with my mom or my dad or my granddad, and those types of experiences. And I think because I put myself in it, and then I also wanted, I think, I mean, I don't know if this is stereotypical a lot or not, but I think a lot of young men don't read that much. And I kind of thought this is a book that a lot of young men would want to read, or if not want to read, want to get somehow. So I thought an audiobook. I know a lot of my son's friends, they listen to podcasts now. They listened, that's a primary way of them getting stories, getting information. So I thought there's a whole, not just men, but women too, but younger people maybe who aren't, and you and I are obviously like bibliophiles, but they're not necessarily. And I thought the audiobook would be a way to get to them. And I do feel like I brought the energy to it. I'm a professor, so just but before talking to you now, I was just 3 hours in the classroom talking. So it's something I know I can do. So I was comfortable with that. And one cool thing is, I went to the studios where the band the Smashing Pumpkins did their album Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. So it's like a mythic kind of like recording studio here in Wicker Park in Chicago. And I went back and I was like, oh, this is where they perform that. So I got in the booth and I was all hyped for it. So it was a totally fun experience. And I hope people like the, hope to buy the book and hope to buy the audiobook too, because I think they'll like it.
The comment you made about people not reading as much, young people not reading as much. This is a very niche book because A, it's about baseball and that limits your audience. B, it's about the Odyssey, which limits the audience. But to put them together, it reminds me of other books. I mean, I have a collection of books about baseball and philosophy, and trying to make two disparate items fit like that. It takes a lot of talent to make it work, and I think you made it work very well.
Thanks. This is a conversation I've had with agents and publishers all along the way, and it was kind of the vision that I'm pleased with this book because this is the book I wanted to write. This is the book that brought the things together. In my own mind, I felt like I was trying to write another Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. We have two unlike things being brought together through. His is more personal memoir. Mine is just sort of like punctuated by personal anecdote. It's just these just little moments of my daughter and I, or me when I'm a kid, bringing together these unlike things. And what I hope, I feel like the title captures this. It's I want someone to see the cover of the book and say, "The Ancient Wisdom of Baseball." Like, how do these two unlike things relate? And then what I hope they get by the end of the book, they'll say, "Oh, I see. They relate to me. They relate to my life. This is the ground upon which the comparison is made, and the meaning is made." So, my daughter right now, she'll go to the Cubs game with me. I mean, we just went to the opening day for the Cubs in Arizona, and that was great. And she flew out so we could celebrate the publication of the book and do that. But she's not a huge baseball fan anymore. She's into fashion. That's her thing. And so that's like her baseball. She practices the ancient wisdom of baseball. And I imagine, other people who are like long distance runners or cooks or as my wife's case, litigators, whatever their thing is that they're into, wherever their passion is, that's where they would pursue excellence. That's where they would find the mythic meaning in their lives. So I hope people aren't can see that I make it niche because our own lives are necessarily like a niche. Even baseball fandom, no one's I don't think anyone's really just a fan of baseball. It's always like with your hats, it's always mediated through a particular team, like you're a Mets fan and that's where you get it. Where in football, people are just fans of the NFL in a lot of ways, but I think baseball, it's local. It's almost like Federalist. It's like the local parochial thing is that which mediates our relationship to the game and everything else. And so I wanted the book to kind of reflect that.
Given the topic of the book, was it hard to find a publisher?
Well, yes, and it was funny because I had some great experiences with editors. I had editors at university presses and editors at like big mainstream presses. Have long conversations with me, and like they got it. Like when they read the prose, read those opening chapters about growing up in Boston and Fisk in Fenway Park and Odysseus, they got it and they were all. But then when the marketing people got a hold of it, they'd be like, "Ah, he doesn't have a baseball platform. He's not a baseball person. What are we going to do?" And they wanted, and there was advice to like, "Oh, make it just purely into the ancient wisdom." Or purely into baseball, or do it this way or that way. And so we ended up going with a small hybrid press in Austin, Texas, Greenleaf, who was great, which I'm really pleased with how the book has come out.
And it is an excellent book. I highly recommend it. We've been talking with Christian Shepherd, author of The Ancient Wisdom of Baseball, Lessons for Life from Homer's Odyssey to the World Series. Christian, thank you very much for talking with us today. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much.